This lecture is brought to you by the virtual campus of the Reformed Baptist Seminary. For information on other courses or seminary programs, please contact us at virtual.seminary.org.
We have been considering SCOTUS and Occam, nominalists. There is a subtle shift that's developing in the late Middle Ages on the issue of what man is capable of and what God rewards by way of grace in salvation. And all of this comes to a head in the theology of Gabriel Biel. You can see by his dates, 1420, 1495, that Gabriel Biel, he was alive just before, he was kind of like his generation was the generation just before Luther's. Well, Occam's greatest disciple was Gabriel Biel, educated at Heidelberg and Erfurt. This philosopher-theologian first achieved fame as a preacher, first at Mainz and then at Urach. And with Count Eberhard of Wittenberg, he was responsible for founding the University of Tübingen, where he held the professorial chair of theology from 1484. And his best-known works are his commentary on the sentences of Peter Lombard. You weren't anybody if he didn't write a commentary on that. And his lectures on an exposition of the canon of the Mass. And then thirdly, his sermons. Unlike Occam, who was excommunicated for his views, and obviously somebody excommunicated by the Catholic Church is not going to be looked upon as a saint or one that's still viewed as being the pattern. Unlike him for being excommunicated and also because Occam sided with the spiritual Franciscans in opposition to Pope John the 22nd, Biel was widely accepted as a loyal servant of the Church. And unlike Duns Scotus, whose writings often were virtually unintelligible, Biel, with his oratorical skills, was able to popularize the nominalism that he had embraced and persuade many of his views. The two theological instructors under whom Luther sat as a monk were both students of Gabriel Biel. Luther remembered later, years later, that it was Biel's treatise on the Mass that he had been required to read prior to his ordination. His thorough acquaintance with Biel's writings stood him in good stead, for his first theological opponents were very adept at drawing upon the arsenal of the arguments used by Occam and Biel in defense of their views. And even after the Reformation had been well established, Biel was a force to be reckoned with, and so much so that he was quoted as a Catholic authority at the Council of Trent. Now, first of all, as we analyze his teaching in connection with this, what he says about fallen man and his remaining capabilities. It is certainly not an overstatement to say that the Occamists in general and Biel in particular were optimistic about human nature and its ability to choose and even do that which is good. This does not mean, of course, that Biel altogether overlooked the catastrophic effects of the fall in Adam's posterity. With Aquinas, he understood original sin as to its form to be the absence of original justice and recognized concupiscence as its material expression. He speaks about concupiscence as the tinder of sin, which in this life is never extinguished, even by the infusion of grace. As a result of the fall, man has been stripped of the gracious gifts of God and grievously wounded in his natural powers. So he, again, language similar to Aquinas. And for this reason, man is in need of more than pardon, than acceptance. His wounded nature is also in need of healing. In order that a thorough recovery might take place, it's not enough for our Lord through forgiveness to drive out the disease. Such a cure would fall short of complete healing. Therefore, our Savior imparts to us spiritual health by the infusion of grace. But, as David Steinmetz has observed, Biel's pessimism is more apparent than real. It is more than offset by his confidence that even sinful men and women are capable of heroic moral achievement. The fall, disastrous as it was, nevertheless did not extinguish the fundamental goodness of human nature and the endowments with which it was created. Though man's nature has been grievously wounded, he has not been deprived of his reason or his free will. He's also retained the use of his synderesis. This is a very important term to get a hold of. Used by the mystics, used by the nominalists, especially by Veal. It could be translated, often another word that he uses is the scintilla conscientiae, the spark of conscience. He has this synderesis, the spark by which he is naturally inclined to do good and refrain from evil. And a particular significance is Beale's doctrine of the freedom of the will. Though he is known to stress the primacy of the will and has traditionally been classified as a voluntarist, so he would be truly a nominalist in that regard, he is also emphatic that the will is blind without the guidance of the intellect. Because Beale has thus conceives of the will and the intellect as working together in tandem, he regards libertas or freedom as a corollary of rationality. As inalienable constituents of man's nature, both have remained intact even after the fall. For Beale, free will is that power of the soul by which a man is able to distinguish and choose between good and evil, and by which he is distinguished from animals. And that the will is free is evident from common experience, and it requires no further demonstration. And the breadth and scope that Beale gives to free will is breathtaking. So you can see how things are shifting more and more as the later you get in the Middle Ages. Now, some of the tenets are these. By his free will, a man may choose a morally good act, ex puris naturalibus, out of his purely natural condition, without the need for grace. And in this connection, Beale qualifies his position by saying that when he speaks of the purely natural state, he does not mean, therefore, exclude the general cooperation of God as the first cause. His definition of the natural state, it reads, with the purely natural state is meant the nature or substance of the soul with the qualities and actions belonging to nature, exclusive of qualities and gifts supernaturally infused by God alone. Another thing, well, the basic first point is the out of his natural condition, he's able to choose good, man is. Man is able, secondly, by the use of his free will and other natural faculties to implement the law, quod substantium actus, according to the substance of the act. The outward act of the law requires. He's able to do that, but he's not able to do so quod intentium principientis, according to the intention of the lawgiver. This is a very important distinction in late medieval thinking. You can do the external, but not what God requires from the heart, according to the intention of the lawgiver. In other words, man is able to fulfill the external requirements of the law, but is unable to fulfill the law in the precise manner in which God intended. The acts by which he fulfills the external requirements of the law are not fully meritorious. They're not condign merit. That stage number four in that whole step thing that we went through before. What we do is not condign merit without the presence of the habit of infused grace. And for the fulfillment of the law, according to the intention of the lawgiver, this infused grace is necessary. He also says that ex puris naturalibus, free will is able to avoid mortal sin. So purely in nature, state of nature, you can avoid mortal sin. Ex puris naturalibus, free will is able to love God above everything else. Now this is an astounding assertion. And then ex suis naturalibus, out of its natural condition, free will is able to dispose itself toward the reception of the gift of grace. Now these positions all underscore how much rides on the exercise of free will. And yes, those steps in the direction of salvation, while one is still in a state of nature, depend upon the general cooperation of God. And the meritorious value of those good deeds performed whilst one is in a state of grace depend upon the divine infusion of grace. But whether one is in a state of nature or grace, everything hinges on the exercise of his free will. Of even those actions performed while one is a state of grace, Beale insists, as Lombard said, meritorious acts depend upon two factors, our free will and grace. There is no human merit that does not depend partly on free will. The principal cause of meritorious moral action, however, is attributed to grace. But grace does not determine the will. The will can ignore the prompting of grace and lose it by its own default. So the will is sovereign. And if these things are true, who can overestimate the importance of using one's free will right? The fulcrum is in man's hands. Let him use its power to the full. His eternal salvation depends upon it. So this is one aspect of his theology, his remaining, fallen man's remaining faculties, capabilities, especially free will. And then there is the Fassari Code, Ense Est, and the Covenant. Beale's optimism with respect to man's condition is also reflected in his teaching concerning the first stage of the way of salvation, namely, the Facientes Code, Ense Est, doing what's best, the best you can do. Beale interprets the axiom to mean that by virtue of God's decree, his potentia ordinata, and due to his great generosity, man can elicit the first grace of salvation. He can get the infused grace by simply doing all that is in him. For God accepts the act of the one who does all that is in him, actum facientes quod ense est, as a sufficient reason, he says, for awarding him the first grace, not out of justice, but out of his liberality. So God didn't have to do it, but he is gracious, and he does it. You do the best you can, and God's gracious to give you the next blessing. But the soul, by removing the obstacle, by ceasing from the act of or consent of sin, and by turning itself rightly toward God, as to its first principle and end, does all that is in it. Facit quod ense est. Therefore, God accepts the act of removing the obstacle and the turning toward God as a reason for infusing grace. And finally, therefore, by removing the obstacle and by turning toward God, one merits grace. De congruo. Now, reminiscent of the teaching of Alan of Lilly and Hugh of St. Cyr that man's preparation for justification involves a removal of an obstacle to grace, Beale asserts that doing one's very best includes removing the obstacle of sin, that is, mortal sin, by refraining from consenting to sin and from the sinful act in itself. And thus far, the Fassari Code and say yes, doing the best you can, it coincides with the contribution of penance. But at the same time, it is also a positive side, the soul turning itself rightly toward God. Or it could be translated as the Latin phrase, eliciendo bonum motum in Deo, bringing forth a good impulse toward God. So not only does free will capable of turning away from the sin, but also of having a good impulse toward God. Beale is persuaded that the natural man is able to prepare himself for the reception of grace by turning his will in a new direction, away from sin and unto God. And thus it may be seen that Beale's radical doctrine of free will, that even the natural man is fully capable of choosing the good and turning to God, is an integral part of his understanding of the Fassari Code Ense Est. And yes, as noted above, in this connection Beale speaks of the cooperative assistance of God. But the act itself proceeds from man in his purely natural state, altogether apart from any supernatural infusion of grace. God, however, is under no moral obligation to pardon a sinner and bestow upon him the supernatural gift of infused grace simply because he has done his best in turning from sin to God. After all, when the sinner does penance for his sin and brings forth his good impulse toward God, he only does what it was his obligation to do. But, Beale hastens to add, let none despair. And the addition to the good news about the residual moral capacities of fallen human nature, the preacher announces another piece of good news. By his covenant, God has put himself under obligation to give the first grace to the man who desists from sin and turns to him. The axiom, you see, he's preaching the gospel in his view. God is really gracious. I'm announcing this grace. The axiom, faciente quod in se est Deus non denigrat gratium, God will not deny grace to the man who does what is in him, is to be interpreted in covenantal terms. The link between doing quod in se est, the best you can, and the remission of sins is not found in the nature of the actions of the returning sinner, that he's doing his best, but in the covenant. Alan of Lilly, in the earliest Franciscan school, had illustrated the axiom by the analogy of a shutter in the rays of sun. You remove the obstacle by opening the windows. Implicit in this analogy is a concept of ontological causality. Ontological is the theory of being. The nature of the action itself, the removal of the obstacle, the shutter, is the cause of the effect, the entrance of the sunlight, that is grace. But Beale and the theologians of the Via Moderna operated with a concept of covenantal causality, according to which the relationship between a man's action and the divine response is bound up with the divine ordination rather than the nature of the actions themselves. And by his pactum, God has graciously ordained that the act of turning from sin to God shall be accepted as worthy of grace. And although man is able to remove an obstacle to grace, it is entirely up to God whether or not he will reward such an action with remission of sins. But due to the pactum, man is able to initiate a course of action by which he places God under obligation to dispense the needed grace. And from the standpoint of his potentia absoluta, his absolute power, God is under no obligation to deal with sinners in such a generous manner. But from the standpoint of his potentia ordinata, what the nominalist championed, the obligations God has assumed under the covenant are absolute and immutable. And Beale is utterly convinced that by this covenantal commitment to bestow upon those who do their best such a disproportionate reward, the grace of God is magnified exceedingly. In the peroration of one of his sermons, he eloquently extols what is to him a lavish dispensation of grace. And here, quoting from his sermon on the circumcision of the Lord, "Thus God has established the rule, the covenant, that whoever turns to him and does what he can will receive forgiveness of sins from God. God infuses assisting grace into such a man who is thus taken back into friendship, as is written in John, grace and truth came through Christ. So that this might be more easily understood, I shall tell a parable. Let us say that there is a most lenient king who shows so much mercy to his people that he publishes a decree saying that he will embrace with his favor any of his enemies who desire his friendship, provided that they mend their ways for the present and the future. Furthermore, the king orders that all who have received, who have been received into this fashion into his friendship will receive a golden ring to honor all who are dedicated to his regime, so that such a friend of the king may be known to all. The king gives to such a man a way of delegation of his royal authority, such a position that every work done to the honor of the king, regardless of where performed or how large or how small it is, shall be rewarded by the king above and beyond its value. And to give him extra strength to perform this kind of meritorious work, precious and powerful stones are inserted into the ring to encourage him who wears it, so that his body does not fail him when he needs it, but increases in ability to gain further rewards the more the body is exercised and accustomed to resist every adverse force." How could one ever praise highly enough for the clemency and the preciousness of the gifts of such a king? "Behold, such is our King and Savior. The gift is grace, which is bestowed abundantly upon us, which is to the soul what is the ring to the body in the parable. And having been offered salvation on such gracious terms, it's now up to the sinner to do his part. It's up to the sinner to mend his ways and accept the golden ring of the King. And because it's within his power, everybody must comply, or within the power of everyone to comply with the gracious terms of the covenant, failure to do so is inexcusable." David Steinmetz draws out the application. God gives grace to men and women who use the capacities which they have, right reason, free will, conscience, and synderesis. Salvation is not only available on reasonable terms, it is universally acceptable. Sinners cannot stand before Christ at the last judgment and plead that they could not do what was in them. They can only ruefully admit that they did not do it. Everything hangs on the free will of the sinner. Even God does not predetermine human destiny. In short, Beale teaches that sinners can earn grace by perfect obedience to the inner meaning of the law. What makes this gospel good news rather than bad is that sinners can do what they should. Thank God we have a more gracious gospel than that. But now, a third point in terms of Beale's theology. And with this, we'll be done with Beale. If, as Beale insists, the natural man is able to avoid mortal sin and thus prepare himself for the first grace, what shall be said in answer to the objection raised by Gregory of Rimini back in 1358, or before 30, that's when he died, the objection that the universal omission of the supreme love to God enjoined by the first table of the law means that mortal sin cannot be avoided by the natural man. You see, Beale has said you can avoid mortal sin, but Gregory said you couldn't. To Beale, this question poses no difficulty. If one accepts, as he does, the presupposition that man in his natural state is able to choose an act expressive of the highest love to God. In this very act, the ultimate preparation for grace lies. Loving God above all things is not an act confined to those who have experienced the awakening power of infused grace. And for Beale, such a position is inevitable if one carries out the doctrine of free will to its logical conclusion. It's also the logical outcome of a proper understanding of the relationship between the will and the intellect. The doctrine that man, purely out of his natural abilities, is able to love God above all things is based on the sound presupposition that the will is able to follow the dictates of right reason. And if in the case of false love it's possible for a man who is presented with the attractive qualities of the created object to love that object above all things, to love a woman, for instance, how much more must it be possible for the will to give heed to reason when it presents God as the summum bonum, the highest good, who ought to be loved above all things? And if it's possible for the natural man to love God above all things, she's going way beyond Aquinas. Aquinas never would have said that, the natural man could do that. If that's possible, and if it's required of man that he prepare himself for grace by doing what's in him, then love for God above all things is part of the required preparation for grace. Now, this does not mean, however, that the natural man is able to love God in a meritorious manner, for it's impossible to perform a meritorious act apart from grace. And therefore, Beale feels constrained to distinguish between the non-meritorious love of the natural man and the meritorious love produced by grace. The natural man can choose an act of love to God according to substance, but not according to the requirements of the deed and the intention of the one who commands it. So you can do the external act. The former, the external act, not the latter, is what is required for an appropriate preparation for grace. And yet, according to his bounty and grace, God has placed himself under covenant obligation to accept what is inferior and reward it with his grace. Beale also explains that the act of natural love to God coincides temporally with the gracious infusion of the habit of love. It is not possible to separate this act from grace. And though man is able by his natural powers to choose an act of supreme love for God, without the gift of grace, he cannot follow it up. But grace is bestowed simultaneously with the natural choice to love God and completes it. It is through the concurrence of grace, its actual joining in the production of an act of love, that it becomes meritorious. And all of these subtle distinctions notwithstanding, the bottom line of this aspect of Beale's teaching is this: even the infected human will, apart from the supernatural assistance of divine grace, is capable of loving God above everything else, at least for a flickering moment of time. In spite of the fall, man's capacity for loving God more than his wife, children, possessions, and himself has never been wholly lost. This does not mean, however, that it's now easy for him to love God supremely. Whereas it was easy for him to do this before the fall, it's now exceedingly difficult. Man can never love God as perfectly and easily as with grace. Nevertheless, he can and must love God supremely, if he's ever to receive the grace of God. Sinners must summon up their inner resources, turn a deaf ear to the voice of concupiscence, and by sheer force of will do what for Adam and Eve was a spontaneous, unforced, unselfconscious act. But hard or easy, the act still can be done, as Steinmetz puts it. Such was the teaching that was in vogue when Martin Luther began his theological studies at the University of Erfurt. Is it any wonder that Luther was tormented in soul? To get grace, you've got to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. You've got to start out that. And you're able to do that. You're able to take that first step. And he only felt hatred to God. He was mad that God damned people. And he could never figure this business out, especially when we read passages like that he is a righteous. The righteousness of God has appeared. He comes across that statement there early on in the book of Romans, and this disturbs him greatly. It's because of his indoctrination with his teaching of Beale. Well, it would be helpful if we could take a few minutes to get right into the beginning of Luther's response to this. Do we have a little bit of time to do that?
Yes, I don't think any of us have any plans. We can stay a little bit.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I think it would be helpful if we could do this and not wait till tomorrow. So we'll take up Luther's early conceptions of the extent of man's sinfulness. And first of all, the influence of nominalism during Luther's years of training. Among the competing systems of thought which vied for Luther's allegiance during his formative years, none was more influential than that of nominalism. And although his lectures and his table talk swarm with references to Aquinas' Summa Theologica, none of these references show anything more than a superficial acquaintance with the thinking of the great systematist. What Luther knew best were the writings of Augustine, those of the German mystics, including the Theologia Germanica, the writings of Tauler. He published the Theologia Germanica. And also the nominalist commentaries on the sentences of Peter Lombard, especially Beale's Collectorium Circulator Libro Centarium. And Melanchthon testifies that Luther studied with pleasure the commentaries of Beale, D'Ali, and Ockham, and knew them so thoroughly that in later years he was able to quote from these writings by heart. With respect to the doctrines of sin and grace, no writings made such a profound impact on the young Luther as those of Gabriel Beale. His preparations for ordination involved, above all else, a mastery of Beale's canon of the Mass. And sensitive as he was upon reading this work, Luther all the more approached the sacred rite with an overwhelming sense of the divine majesty and of the dreadful powers invested in the one who dispensed the sacramental host. And even more so than this, the nominalist interpretation of the axiom, facere codens est, doing the best you can, along with this insistence on the love of God for God's sake as a necessary prerequisite to the reception of grace, brought about Luther's crisis of conscience. As late as 1515, in his commentary on Psalm 115, and verse 1, we find Luther upholding the usual nominalist position regarding preparation for grace, the axiom facere codens est, congruent merit, and the covenant by which God rewards man's preparations for grace. He says the teachers correctly say that to a man who does what is in him, there's that same phrase, that God gives grace without fail. And though he could not prepare himself for grace on the basis of worth, de condino, that super grace, because the grace is beyond compare, yet he may well prepare himself on the basis of fitness, congruo, because of this promise of God and the covenant of his mercy. He bestows everything gratis and only on the basis of the promise of his mercy, although he wants us to be prepared for this as much as lies in us. Hence, as the law was the figure and preparation of the people for receiving Christ, so our doing as much as in us disposes us toward grace. He's a thorough disciple of Beale at this point when he writes this. Well, these words were no mere theory with Luther. He studied and preached the word. He performed acts of charity. He fasted and prayed. He punished himself with all manner of penances. In short, day and night he did his utmost to do, code, and say yes. And yet he never felt that his own love out of his own heart, the pure love of God, which Beale had spoken about. And instead of attaining a deal of perfect love of God out of his natural condition, he discovered selfish motives in his heart, what he called concupiscentia. More and more it became apparent to him that there was something desperately wrong with Beale's theories concerning the natural man and the preparations by which he may elicit the grace of God. Luther's own experiences gave the lie to them. "Though I lived as a monk without reproach," he says, "I felt that I was a sinner before God with an extremely disturbed conscience." And now, from his early influence, the tension now between Luther's nominalist training and his own experience. Less than a year after Luther has penned the comments on Psalm 115 quoted above, his exposition of Romans 14 and verse 1 and 15:16 makes it evident that the tension between his nominalist training and his own experience has grown to a head. On one hand, he declares that faith in the doctrine of the Pharisaic est has overturned almost the whole church. He begins to see that's a terrible doctrine. And this statement clearly indicates that the problem of the Pharisaic est was not a marginal concern in Luther's mental world, and that Luther had undergone a radical shift in his thinking with respect to this doctrine. On the other hand, in the same commentary, he attempts to salvage the doctrine by distinguishing between its Pelagian interpretation and the doctrine itself. And this inconsistency, however, should not surprise us, seeing that a short time before Luther had given such enthusiastic support to the doctrine. And then, still seeing his progress, we come now to Luther's unambiguous rejection of the nominalist conception of the sinner's preparation for grace. Later in the same year, on September 25, 1516, Luther chaired a disputation regarding theses for which he was largely responsible, one of which stated that the sinner cannot prepare himself for grace, either de congruo or de condino. This position unambiguously knocked the legs out from under the doctrine of the Pharisaic est, as the nominalist had propounded it. The inescapable inference of this thesis is that the man who does what is in him, with his natural reason or will, he sins. It's not grace, it's sin. And in this disputation, we also see unmistakable evidence that a Copernican revolution in his thinking with respect to the doctrine of free will had taken place. And this 9 years prior to the writing of The Bondage of the Will. In the 1516 disputation, he openly declares, "The will of man without grace is not free, but enslaved." And then we come finally to Luther's open attack on the nominalist position. Having won the battle in his own university, Luther felt constrained to carry the war into the opposite camp. The fall of 1517, at the promotion of Franz Günther to the degree of bachelor, Luther drew up and issued a series of 97 theses. And they should be not confused with the 95 theses. And these were a carefully planned and direct attack on the whole nominalist position set forth by Gabriel Beale, William of Ockham, Pierre d'Ailly, and Duns Scotus. And it's probable that Luther had them printed and sent to Erfurt and Nuremberg. He wanted them to be debated publicly, and he offered to go to Erfurt himself to defend his propositions in the university or in the monastery. In several of these theses, Luther sought to deliver the theology of the church from the Aristotelianism to which it had been shackled by the scholastics. But even more than this, Luther was concerned to deliver the church from the new Pelagianism, as he called it, which had been introduced by these theologians under the cloak of Aristotelian philosophy. As Stephen Osmond has observed, scholastic error disturbed Luther more than scholastic method. And among the errors condemned at the Heidelberg Disputation are the following. And I've given the error in italics and then some sample theses to illustrate it. The first, that the will of man in his natural condition is free to choose the good and reject the evil. He rejects that. And so in number 4, he says, it is therefore true that man, being a bad tree, can only will and do evil. 5, it is false to state that man's inclination is free to choose between either of these two opposites. Indeed, the inclination is not free but captive. This is said in opposition to common opinion. 6, it is false to state that the will can, by nature, conform to correct precept. This is said in opposition to Scotus and Gabriel. As a matter of fact, without the grace of God, the will produces an act that is perverse and evil. And one must concede that the will is not free to strive toward whatever is declared good. This is in opposition to Scotus and Gabriel. And then another error that he rejected, that natural man is able to love God above all things. He says it's absurd to conclude that erring man can love the creature above all things, therefore also God. This is in opposition to Scotus and Gabriel. 16, one ought rather to conclude, since erring man is able to love the creature, it's impossible for him to love God. 17, man is by nature unable to want God to be God. Indeed, he himself wants to be God. It does not want God to be God. Isn't he? How could he love God? He doesn't even want God to be God. To love God is above all things by nature is a fictitious term, a shimmer, as it were. This is common. This is contrary to common teaching. And just by way of note, skipping down here, he does allow a love of friendship for God, but only by grace. An act of friendship is done, not according to nature, but according to prevenient grace. And this is in opposition to Gabriel. And he also stressed that according to nature, man is only capable of a concupiscent love, which is therefore evil. No act is done according to nature that is not an act of concupiscence against God. Another error he rejected, that by doing what is in him, man can take the first step toward God. He says, if it is said of the scripture passages, return to me, and I will return to you, that text they all quoted ad nauseum, draw nigh near to God, and he will draw near to you, and the like, that one is by nature and the other by grace, this is no different from asserting what the Pelagians have said. Another error, that man in a state of nature can prepare himself for grace. And so he says, the best and infallible preparation for grace and the sole disposition for grace is the eternal election and predestination of God. On the part of man, however, nothing precedes grace except indisposition and even rebellion against grace. And then that a man is in a state of nature, that he can remove the obstacles to grace, this whole open the window business. He rejects that. And this is false, that in doing all that one is able to do, he can remove the obstacles to grace. This is in opposition to several authorities. He rejects the notion that God can accept the efforts of a man who is not yet justified. It is not true that God can accept man without his justifying grace. This is in opposition to Occam. The final error, that of his own free will, the man is able to fulfill the requirements of the law. Law quod substantium actus, according to the substance of the act, as you can do the outside part of the job, but not intentionem principiantis, according to the intention of the lawgiver. He says it's dangerous to say that the law commands that an act of obeying the commandment to be done. It's dangerous to say that the law commands that an act of obeying the commandment be done in the grace of God. This is in opposition to the cardinal and Gabriel. And from this it would follow that to have the grace of God is actually a new demand going beyond the law. And it would also follow that fulfilling the law can take the place without the grace of God. Every deed of the law without the grace of God appears good outwardly, but inwardly it is sin. This is in opposition to the scholastics. Well, such is tremendous shift in Luther's thinking very early on in his experience as a doctor of sacred scripture. Any questions before we go? I felt really badly that we had this kind of stuff to have to do in the afternoon. This was, I know, tough going.
You made a couple of remarks about the Pelagianism of the these guys. And Luther ends up, you know, pinning that label on them. It's really kind of interesting because the Roman Catholic Church condemned Pelagianism, but then it seems that at the time of Luther, Pelagianism was alive and well. It's almost as if you can almost characterize the history of the Roman Catholic Church in terms of Pelagianism. In other words, by Luther's time, it's the same old Pelagianism, but now it's more ornate. It's more sophisticated. Yeah. You've got the hierarchy and all of that.
But it would still be
more entrenched.
There's a sense in which Luther's charges are maybe a little bit of an overcharge. Even Gabriel Biel wouldn't go as far as Pelagius and say that it's totally in man's natural ability to do all acts of righteousness, to even live to perfection. That's pure Pelagianism.
Right, right.
So it would have been probably more accurate for Luther to have charged him and these men with semi-Pelagianism. But it was getting very close to outright Pelagianism. It was really getting very almost to that. It was almost to that brink. And so the Catholic Church today, they would repudiate Pelagianism. That's still regarded as a heresy. But it certainly embraces more of a watered down Augustinianism than pure Augustinianism.
Semi-Pelagianism also was condemned, wasn't it?
Back and forth.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of a squirmy little creature there. Basically, I think by the time you come to the Synod of Orange, as I recall, I'd have to look this up. It's been a long time since I was into that, but I kind of think that by then it was accepted. Yes.
When you were talking about Beale and how he kept talking about this covenant or whatever, and how he's so gracious because he's condescending and he makes this bigger deal out of these things that aren't that great, was that covenant based on that axiom, which is God will not deny grace to the man who does what is in him, or is it like on some scripture that they are perverting? I didn't really get where they're basing this idea of this covenant. Where are they getting that from?
I never read anything of quoting the covenant of grace, of saying, you know, going back to Genesis 15 or any of those passages we think of when we think of the covenant of grace.
Mm-hmm. So is it just
it's more of a theological concept than a biblical theological concept. It's a theological concept that had been kind of imposed, more or less. And it's one of the defects of the. I mean, as you read these guys, they're not interacting with Scripture. They're quoting it here and there, kind of as it serves their own purpose. But they're not. It's not like Luther, where everything's being mined out of the Scriptures. And that is the danger of our going too far with our systematics in terms of implications and drawing implications from implications. Other questions, observations? Thank God for the grace of God, for the gospel of grace. Boy, I thank God even, you know, you think that sometimes listening to a couple lectures like this, you know, probably makes you feel like, man alive, why'd we get this inflicted upon us? But what if it was 4 years of this and not just, you know, a couple hours? And you had to memorize this stuff back and forward and read Duns Scotus especially.
You know what? I honestly thought about that. And the main lesson that I'm getting is that we should guard against Reformed scholasticism. We need to be careful about letting our conjectures and theology take on the character of really the wisdom of man, because that's what all of this is. It's it's the wisdom of man applied to religion, hovering above the Scriptures.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's. I will not say that scholasticism had no contributions. I mean, there are certain disciplines of logic that are helpful to have when we're interacting with issues. And so sometimes the condemnation of the so-called reformed scholasticism, I think, goes too far. Oftentimes isn't. I think Turretin is kind of accused of being a reformed scholastic. And, you know, there's you know, some degree of concern about how you know, I'm uncomfortable, for instance, even reading a lot of Dabney, of how much he minds out of natural revelation sometimes. But at the same time, some of that trains you to think.
Sure.
But I always love reading this. I love reading Murray, for instance, just because it's so exegetical, even though he's doing systematics. Okay. Well, it looks like we're done.